offering them choices in how, what, when, and where they learn, the pace, the place, and the mode of delivery. Flexible learning requires a balance of power between institutions and students, and seeks to find ways in which choice can be provided that has to be economically viable and also appropriately manageable for institutions and students alike. My name is Stuart Norton. I'm a Senior Advisor in Learning and Teaching at Advance HE, and I'm leading the update to the Advance HE Student Success Framework series, of which flexible learning forms a key part. I'm delighted to introduce these podcasts that are part of a range of activity linked to the forthcoming Advance HE Literature Review, authored by Professor Mark Loon of Northumbria University, in flexible learning. This review looked in depth at over 100 research articles published between the years 2016 and 2021, and the papers reviewed detailed research undertaken across the world using both quantitative and qualitative, as well as mixed methods approaches. These podcasts complement this review, looking at different yet equally important aspects of flexible learning. The whole series of podcasts are available on the Advance HE website, alongside all the member benefit work that's been undertaken so far and will continue to do so in the Student Success Framework series.
Hello and welcome to Advance HE's podcast on flexible learning. We have a tremendous panel today made up of three eminent experts from three continents. First, we have Professor Roxana Osman, who is Senior Deputy Vice Chancellor Academic at the University of the Witwatersrand in South Africa, and who is also the UNESCO Chair in Teacher Education for Diversity and Development. Then we have Professor Lisa Anderson, Interim Associate Pro Vice Chancellor for Education at the University of Liverpool in the UK, and is also former Co-Vice Chair of the British Academy of Management. And then we've got Professor Keitha Dunstan, Provost at Bond University in Australia and Chair of Universities Australia Deputy Vice Chancellor's Academic Working Group on micro-credentials. And I'm Mark Loon, Professor of Management and Organisation Studies at Northumbria University in the UK, and the author of the recent literature review on flexible learning published by Advance HE. And in terms of today's format, each member will be sharing with us their three views on the state of flexible learning in their own respective contexts, the key issues in flexible learning as they see it, and their views on the future of flexible learning. So, Roxana, may I please start with you with the first question. What is the state of flexible learning in your respective context?
Mark, thank you for this invitation to be on this panel. And it's wonderful to be with Lisa and Keitha. I look forward to this discussion. Thanks for inviting me. I do want to make the point that the South African context is quite diverse. So we have research-intensive universities, we have universities of technologies, and then comprehensive universities. And I do speak from the perspective of a research-intensive university, and I think one needs to keep that in mind when I speak about some of the institutional responses. In my response, I will inevitably talk about the national context, but also the institutional context. So let me give it a go and think about how we think about flexible learning. I do think that we have a problem, not just in South Africa or at my university, but globally, we have a definitional problem around flexible learning. And by that, I mean that it's understood in very different ways by different universities globally, not just on the continent. And some, I think, with the pandemic, most associate flexible learning with online learning or emergency remote learning. And so I think there is this definitional problem. There's also this problem about seeing it as blended learning or hybrid learning and so on. My sense of what we're doing at our university is we've thought a lot about flexible learning institutionally and even nationally. Nationally, I think the tendency is to see it as the distinction between face-to-face full-time higher education versus virtual online education. So I think the state make, or at least nationally, they make that distinction. At the University of the Witwatersrand, particularly at our university, we sort of think about flexible learning as certainly around modes of learning and modes of delivery. But I think our emphasis is far more on the logistics of flexible learning. So in other words, we have pathways to enable flexible learning for the student. And those pathways are face-to-face. So in other words, a student can come full-time to the university. Another pathway would be part-time studies, particularly for people who are working. Another pathway would be occasional studies as a form of flexible learning. Fourth pathway would be the use of short courses. A fifth pathway would be MOOCs. And we have a partnership with edX where we offer MOOCs. And then micro-credentialing is something that we're starting to think about quite a lot. And finally, we have what is called recognition of prior learning. And I think in the Australian context is referred to as accreditation of prior learning, APL, and so on. So our emphasis is quite a lot on different pathways to enable students to flexibly access higher education. And this is no coincidence. You know that we come from a historical background where access to higher education was not allowed to the majority of people, particularly people of color like myself as well. So with the advent of democracy in 1994, these pathways have opened up to enable higher participation in higher education and, of course, to remove the barriers. So institutionally and nationally, there's quite a lot of thinking and action around flexible learning, but most of the thinking and the action is in the domain of pathways. At my own university, yes, we are looking at pathways, and inside of the pathways, we do focus on different pedagogical approaches that allow for flexible learning. And those pedagogical approaches may well be experiential learning to problem-based learning, etc. So ours is a combination of providing pathways and then looking at some pedagogical elements. I have to say at the institutional level, the processes and the structures have not matured so well to enable students to take, for example, a MOOC and a short course and build that towards a formal full-time qualification. I think the processes are not that mature. But it's quite a broad range of offerings in terms of what flexible learning is.
Great. Thank you very much, Roxana. And Lisa.
Yeah, okay. So it's nice to meet you all, first of all, and thank you for inviting me. I'm always wary about being called an expert, so I'll give some views, whether they're expert views or not, I don't know. So I'll talk first of all about my context in the context of the UK, and I think in the UK there are some universities that are really well on in terms of flexible learning and using online resources. You know, the Open University, of course, is a prime example of that, who are very sophisticated, very experienced. I think my university, the University of Liverpool, is probably quite typical of lots of universities in terms of what we do with our full-time undergraduate students. And before I go on to talk about that, we actually also do have a fully online suite of programmes for postgraduates that we've been running since 2001. So we have lots of experience in running online, fully remote learning that we've been doing for an awful long time with some pretty unsophisticated technology to start with. And actually, our technology is still pretty unsophisticated because that helps us get people to get access to it. So it's much more inclusive for students. And so I can talk a little bit about that. But in terms of the broad UK context, I think our university is fairly typical of lots of others in that we woke up to flexible and online learning as the pandemic happened and thought, here's something that we've been thinking about for a long time and now we've really got to do it. So we switched into remote learning mode 2 years ago, along with everybody else, and we've learned as we've gone along. I have to say, we did draw on some of the things that we've done already with our fully online programmes, but before that, really, I would say that we had pockets of good practice across the university, mainly from enthusiasts, people who are really into online and flexible learning, who are doing their own thing and doing great things for students, but without a fully institutional strategy. And that's the point that we're at now. We're thinking about how do we use all of this learning that we've got across the last 2 years and turn that into an institutional strategy. And the way that we're doing that is is talking to our students about what they've enjoyed, how they've learned, what they found interesting and helpful for them, what they would like to see persistent in the future. And actually, a lot of our students are telling us that they did like learning online, but they actually love coming to campus as well, and that that is a real authentic university experience for them. So the conundrum that we're dealing with at the moment is, how do we get this blend? How do we get this so that students can access learning in lots of different ways, but still have that authentic university experience? So how do we use all the things that we've learned about pedagogy, and how do we use all the things that we've learned about how students like to learn, and turn that into something that will give us a model for the future? So that's where we are at the moment.
Great. Thank you very much, Lisa. That was really interesting. And Keitha, views on flexible learning in your context.
Thank you, Mark. And again, it's wonderful to meet you all as well. I think in Australia, our different modes and different approaches to flexible learning are very similar to what the other two speakers mentioned. I think I could say in Australia, we have had quite a disruption to the higher education sector. It was already happening well before COVID, in a sense, largely driven by changes in government policy, much more of a user pay focus, so a lot more competition between universities. So a lot of universities were looking for ways to distinguish themselves, and having different approaches and being more flexible were ways to distinguish themselves, particularly for some of the regional universities that may not have been as attractive to some students, and you know, similar to what others mentioned in terms of online specialisation and so on. I think the other thing that's happened in Australia more recently, and it's kind of like a perfect storm, if you like. So we have this government policy where it's very much user pay, a little bit more vocationally focused and applied than maybe universities would like government policy to be. We have, partially because of that, increased competition from outside the sector. So I'm from a private university, but I'm still from a university. So we have a lot of private providers in Australia who are now in our space. We also have professional bodies who are very much now in our space. And that came together with a very favourable employment environment. So we've had basically continually declining postgraduate numbers for some time. And as you're all aware, and others have already mentioned, you know, the rise of MOOCs and so on, we actually found ourselves in an environment where if universities, and I'll focus a little bit on micro-credentials at this stage, if universities didn't change their approach to how they were dealing with this space, then we simply would have been left behind, and we would have lost what was happening in that postgraduate space. So less emphasis from employers. We used to have the case where employers would pay for the fees for an MBA, for example, for a staff member. They were no longer interested. They just wanted to have employees work on specific skills. So very much we have had it hoisted upon us from a demand perspective, I think. And I think you're aware of the work that University of Australia has done on actually trying to have some guidance on micro-credentials, because this has all happened so quickly, the regulation hasn't kept up. So we don't have standards, we don't have regulation. So it's become a little bit of a wild west. And that's, in fact, what Universities Australia has been trying to do, is to try and put some more guidance on it.
Great. Thank you very much, Keitha. And I'd like to open the floor to colleagues to the questions that you may have for one another in regards to your own context where flexible learning is concerned.
So maybe I can kick off then and actually engage with yourself, Keitha, and that is, I do think that the flexible learning is very well intentioned, but I do think that sometimes big business will use it to define what it means to be a university. So there's that constant challenge of this authentic experience that we want to give, and the need of the economy and big business for quick, fast credentialing. So if University of Australia is trying to put some boundedness to it, what is it trying to do? Is it raising some of the conceptual issues, or is it going with it and then starting to draft the standards? Because it almost feels like universities are on a back foot.
Yeah, I think very much we have been on the back foot. And as I said, I think the regulators have been on the back foot as well, because we do have a lot of suppliers out there with a whole range of different, we'll just call them all micro-credentials, but they all look somewhat different. And there is no standards. And really, that's what we are trying to do. So while the guidance that we've tried to write isn't rules per se, we're basically signalling to the non-higher education providers, unless you design them the way we are saying they should be designed, we're not going to give any recognition for them. And so we're hoping, and there has been some positive feedback so far, is that if we tell them this is the way it should be done, and that would give you the opportunity for university recognition in terms of accreditation or prior learning, then we can actually improve the quality of what's going on. Because as you say, it is exactly our fear. We are certainly concerned about ourselves and being the competition that we're facing, but the biggest concern is the very low quality of that competition and the fact that the market can't discern. So in theory, and this is sort of the debate we have with government, it sounds great, you know, user pays, let the market demand determine it and let universities compete with the private sector. But if the private sector is not regulated in terms of providing quality, then the outcome for the country is not what it should be.
Can I just ask what input you get from employers and in terms of developing those micro-credentials and how geared they are to the needs of the economy and of those employers?
So some of them, I guess the best case scenario, and this, I mean, if I talk about what Bond's doing at the moment, we actually do work in partnership with some of the organisations and ask them what are the schools that they're looking for and what do they want these programs to be. And then we develop the micro-credential to order, I suppose. And so rather than what we've traditionally done in the past with postgraduate programs, where we kind of decided what we thought should be in them. And yes, we have advisory boards and so on, but basically we design the subjects, is that they actually directly feed into the micro-credentials and then we stack them into subjects. So it's actually been driving our curriculum from the bottom and from the market rather than us pushing down to them. And it does work well.
Yeah, it sounds great.
Thank you very much, colleagues. Now I'd like to move on to the second question. So, and I suppose, you know, that preceding conversation has touched on this a little bit, but the second question is really about key issues in flexible learning as you see it. Roxana, shall we start with yourself again?
Sure. So I think you can see in the different context, whether it's the European context, the African context, or the Australian context, there's a complexity, there's a level of complexity around flexible learning. It's not just about creating opportunities for people to access learning. It's not just that. And I think one of the key issues that we need to take into account is we need to be very clear about what we mean by flexible learning and what we are pursuing when we engage in what we call flexible learning. My fear is that we create a new orthodoxy in a sense that while it can be very innovative, it can also be remarkably inflexible by positioning universities merely as service providers to the economy. And we know that what it means to be a university is to enable students to have access to a full learning experience, which goes beyond the content. So for me, that issue is we need to be very clear about what do we understand by flexible learning and what are we pursuing when we take on the idea of flexible learning. In the South African context, yes, by all means, we have a history of exclusion. So we're very keen on access. But when you do access, you need to think very much about the issue on quality. And I think Kiesa is mentioned that the issue about quality, you can certainly increase participation rates, but there's no guarantee that you'll increase success rates by flexible pathways or even flexible approaches or flexible pedagogies. The third element is that I do think if universities are engaging in whichever form of flexible learning you want to talk about, whether it's just a new mode of delivery like online or a new pedagogy, I do think that we need to take colleagues with us. So you've got to have I think one of the issues is trying to have in the institution a sort of bottom-up approach. by all means, design the standards and the content and so on, but you're going to need to take your colleagues. We're going to need to take colleagues with us. And part of this bottom-up approach will require some kind of professional staff development, because we have to reorientate universities to new modes of delivery, new pedagogies, new kinds of students, and new expectations from students and from the market. So I think it's for university leaders, it's going to be quite an interesting tightrope. You're going to have to manage the tensions in a way that don't compromise who we are as a university and what it means to be a university. So I think this flexible learning is great, but you need to keep a pretty good check on what you want from it and what are you trying to do with it. So those are, for me, conceptually some of the big issues. But I also think as you get more and more online, you've got to think about how more and more exclusionary you get, because the access to bandwidth and data is not quite the same, and it's not even across countries, across continents. Even within the same country, there are different levels of access to bandwidth. And we need to be careful that this kind of approach doesn't become, one, a new orthodoxy, two, exclusionary practice, and number three, end up having consequences that we never imagined because we didn't think about some of the exclusionary elements that flexible learning and flexible approaches offer us. So for me, those would be the key issues, would be being very clear about what you want from this flexible learning, what should it deliver. Number two, make sure that you keep your eye on quality and so on. Number three, ensure that you take staff with you, try to have a bottom-up approach. And number four, always keep the eye on who's excluded when we're doing the flexible approaches. And finally, I have a stake in ensuring what it means to be a university and who we are as a university. Those are important questions that we cannot lose sight of those as we go down this path.
Thank you, Ruxana. That's really interesting. You know, lots of food for thought. Thank you. Following the same pattern, Lisa, your views on the issues of flexible learning.
Yeah, so just picking up on some of those issues that Ruxana was talking about, I agree. And for me, the top of my list was thinking about the strategy and how we create a strategy for flexible learning in universities, and very much deciding what we want to do as an institution and the choices that we make as an institution around flexible learning. And I think that will be different for every institution. And there are choices to be made there about, you know, who your students are and how you want them to learn. And those are fairly fundamental questions that I think we make certain assumptions about in universities. And I think those are conversations that we need to have and decisions that we need to make that will influence the strategy that we take for flexible learning, because we then have to make decisions about the resources that we allocate to flexible learning and the investment that we make in that. So every institution is going to be different. We don't all have to be the same. And I think there's room for lots of different approaches rather than a one size fits all. I think one of the main issues for me is, again, following on from something that Ruxana was talking about, these ideas of community and engagement. For me, that a university is a community of learners and researchers, and that's what we do. And I think that identity is really important, and I think we keep that, and I think we can with flexible learning. We certainly have with our fully online learning approach, but that was because we thought about it very carefully. We thought about how we created communities, how we developed a pedagogy that was very much focused on community and discussion and engagement, and again, it's something that needs careful thought. And I also think we need to think about how different sorts of students want different approaches. So an 18-year-old full-time undergraduate wants something very different to somebody who's 35 and wants to do a master's program alongside work. It really isn't a one-size-fits-all. But actually, everybody can be part of that learning community. There are just different pedagogies within it. And just two more points. The second to the last one I would say is, I think we need to be careful about using technology for the sake of using technology, because it's a sexy and a modern thing to do. Actually, you know, pedagogy should lead, learning should lead, and then we use technology to support that. There's lots of fantastic technology out there and lots of enthusiasts for it. But, you know, learners first is what I think about, technology second. And finally, my last point in this is that I think there is a real opportunity here to reach those hard to reach learners and students. So for universities to open up learning to students who've never been able to access it before, fully taking on board what Ruxana's saying about technology and how we need to be careful about assuming that everybody has access to it. But I think there are some fantastic opportunities here in thinking about who our hard to reach learners are and how flexible learning can help us reach them.
Thank you, Lisa. Absolutely. I mean, so being an ambidextrous institution in terms of keeping true to oneself, but also at the same time moving on with the times. Thank you. Keitha, what are your views on the issues of flexible learning?
Yeah, thank you. And a very comprehensive coverage both of the other speakers. So in total agreement of the dangers here. And as you were both speaking, I'm thinking we've just got to be careful that we don't get carried away with, you know, the next big thing. And that this is something that we all need to do just for the sake of doing it. And I think there is a little bit of danger with that. And I think for all of us, universities across the world, we did a fabulous job in response to COVID and embracing technological solutions to remote learning very, very quickly. And sort of staff are quite excited about it. But I think we can go too far. And so we do have to think about what is it that universities are actually very good at and what have we done for a long time? And we shouldn't just sort of jump to the next thing just because, as you both have already said, that just because the technology is there doesn't mean that we fully have to have it as the only solution for us. And I think you've both already said it in terms of the dangers with the quality, because I think there is a temptation sometimes, certainly I'll blown up with my colleagues, that I would see sometimes what they are saying is, well, I'm doing this because I want to be flexible or I want to be innovative, is sometimes excuses for just not doing things thoroughly or the way we would like to do it. And in particular, so at Bond this year, we are back fully face-to-face with students, and students are very, very excited to be back face-to-face. But I still have some staff who really enjoyed remote teaching, especially if it happened to be asynchronous remote teaching. And I'm saying, no, that's not what the students are looking for, which both Ruxana and Lisa have said. So yes, it has its benefits, but we also have to have balance and be very careful about quality.
Thank you very much, Keitha. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's the cautious approach is the way to go, because, you know, flexible learning is much more than just technology. It's the whole thing that universities offer. Thank you.
I was just going to ask Ruxana, so have you worked out how, I guess what I'm struggling with is from a quality assurance point of view, how to encourage people to be innovative, how to respond to student needs in terms of the flexibility that they're looking for, but still maintain that quality, and how do we train the staff to be able to deliver it in a quality way? So have you worked out how to do that?
So as you know, we're all learning on the go, but the one thing yet I have done in the last little while with my colleagues with whom I work is the following. So assessment has come up as a big issue during COVID. And you'll know that some colleagues are very suspicious of any other form of assessing students other than a high pressure, time-bound form of assessment. So in fact, when we speak about the future of flexible learning, I'll speak a little bit more about that. So assessment has been an area that has come up, and mostly also to ensure staff that actually when you use an alternate mode of assessment, it's not necessarily a dilution of how you testing content and so on. So one of the things I have done as part of developing the quality assurance is I've revised the standing orders on assessment. So pre-COVID, we had standing orders on if you assess, you're going to have 50% of the work done in this mode, another 50% done in an examination context, another in handing in a take-home exam, etc. So I've taken a lot of time to revise the standing orders so that there's ample opportunity for innovation for staff members while giving them comfort that you're still operating within the university policy and framework. So one was the revision of the standing orders. The other is establishment of a learning community of practice where people come and present their work and talk about different ways in which they're assessing or different ways in which they're teaching. And in some ways, having that kind of a platform has been very useful because people from physics are able to see how people in geography are doing it or in humanities. There's an assumption that the humanities is the only place where you can do this kind of innovation and you can't do it in physics or chemistry and so on. So this community of practice has been very good in presenting work and then talking about it in relation to the standing orders, which talk to the quality of the issues. So in some ways saying the academic is the custodian of the assessment methods and the content, you are the disciplinary expert. But here are a whole lot of ways in which you can assess that content. So that's the way we've looked at the quality question, Keitha, is almost, again, a bottom-up approach. Rather than saying everyone needs to ensure the quality is good, ensuring that we're not lowering standards, etc., I've created a framework, which are the standards, and then a community where the two can come together. And that seems to be working quite well, where I can see a greater appetite now institutionally for exploring flexible assessment instead of just imagining that the university just wants everything to be easy for students, you know? So that's one of the ways we've done it.
Any other question? Lisa?
Yeah, I'm interested in how both of you approach this this question of diversity, and I'm thinking particularly of neurodiversity and how we actually, cater and engage students, neurodiverse students, particularly if we're relying on technology and if you've come across that, if you've tackled that, and if so, how you've done it.
I have successfully tackled it, but we've certainly come across it. And I guess particularly with the challenges we all had with COVID, there were some learners that really struggled with the remote delivery and not being face to face. And it was difficult. And so it really does highlight that, as you mentioned earlier, Lisa, it's not the same for everyone and everyone learns differently and everyone has different needs. So I think, again, whenever we are doing these kinds of innovations, that definitely needs to be taken into account because you don't want to change things in a way that is going to be detrimental for those that perhaps have some special needs. And in the case of Bond, because we're a small private university, our, I guess, mainstay are our small face-to-face classes, and neurodiverse students tend to flourish in those situations. And that's much more difficult to replicate, for example, in an online environment.
Yeah. So I'm thinking particularly in terms of the learning support that we can give by using flexible learning and how we can give.
Oh, yes. Yeah. On the positive side, yes.
I mean, we've not got there yet. This is what we're thinking about in terms of how flexible and online can actually offer some opportunities for neurodiverse and all sorts of learners with any kinds of support needs that you can create support through that learners can access and help them learn how to access the right kind of support for them. Mm. And of course, some of that has to be face-to-face.
Yeah. So what we actually did right in the middle of COVID, in fact, is we put out a call for accommodating students on campus for social justice issues. So it included neurodiverse students living in homes where there was gender-based harm, students living in homes where there might have been bandwidth problems, etc. So by application, during the full lockdown, we allowed some 5,000 students to come back into residence. And what that meant was we had to abide by COVID regulations. We had to go to single occupancy rooms, ensure that food was delivered at an individual level, etc. So within all the COVID protocols, we took a social justice approach and allowed a certain number of students to come back onto campus to be able to access the full range of services, from careers and counseling to mental health to financial guidance to gender and bullying support, etc. We made a social justice cluster, and then we provided the services, and those services were provided in an online form and in a face-to-face, but within the COVID protocols. And this is the first year now, 2022, where we will move from single occupancy to two people in a room. But that's how we dealt with the cohort of students that had particular challenges around the issues that I've just mentioned.
Thank you. Thanks very much, colleagues. And now moving on to the last question. Keitha, can I start with yourself? How do you see the future of flexible learning?
Yes, so I really do think it relates back to that disruption that I was talking about, because I think we do know what universities are very good at, but one of the things that we haven't always been as good at as we would like to be is innovating. So we do tend to sometimes cling to traditions and the way that we have always done things. And my concern is if we continue to do that, we could go the way of the dinosaurs, because there are competitors out there. There are Googles, there are Microsofts, there are others who potentially could replace the education that we have been providing. So I don't think we can take for granted that supremacy that we sort of have inherited from the past, that will continue. So I think we do have to be open to different ways of thinking and doing and behaving. And I think flexible learning and different delivery options and different modes of operating are very much part of that. I think others have already mentioned, recognition of prior learning, accreditation of prior learning. There's been a lot of talk in Australia that, particularly in the postgraduate spaces, that universities might be likely to more become like curators of the learning packages that students self-direct for themselves, that they will actually pieces of things, and then we will work out how to curate that into a degree. And when we talk about that, our expectation is that perhaps universities might become a little more specialized, because at least in Australia, every university is basically a large, broad, comprehensive university, and we all offer the same programs and we all offer everything. And does that necessarily need to be the case moving forward, where people can pick and choose? And I think, basically, if I bring it back to micro-credentials for a little bit, one of the things that is happening in Australia, and as I mentioned, this is very much the focus of government policy at the moment, is they have invested in developing what's going to be called a national credentials platform. And hasn't existed yet. I am on an advisory board helping set it up, but its intention is to provide a way for students to collate all of their learning in one place that can gain recognition from others. So the intention is that employers can look up a person and see all of the things that they have done, and potentially, at least some in the government believe, that might make it less likely that students will want degrees, because they won't need degrees, because they will have these recognised items of learning on this credentials platform. So these are all things that could be disruptions to us in the future, but I think there'll always be a place for universities as long as we take that higher ground and we do stay high quality and do assure that quality.
Wow. Yeah, I've not heard of that, Keitha. That's really interesting. Really can't wait to see what happens with that. Thank you. Lisa?
Yeah, that was really interesting, Keitha. Thank you for that. It's kind of, we're just thinking about micro-credentialing, and obviously you're way ahead of us, so I'm going to have a look at what Bond are doing and see what we can learn from you, and what's happening in Australia as well. Because actually top of my list for the future was really something that comes from the UK government in terms of what it expects from universities, and that's around social mobility and employability and what that means and how flexible learning can support that drive from the government, and obviously something that universities should be engaging in both from a regional, national and international basis. So I think we really need to start exploring what flexible learning actually, how it can help us achieve those objectives. My other thoughts about the future are this idea of very much keeping that community focus. How do we keep the university as a learning community, and how do we make sure that flexible learning and flexible learners are included in that community? And what does that sense of community feel like if you are a remote or a flexible learner who's not on campus all the time? How do we engage students in particular? Also, how do we provide choice for students, and how do we resource that choice for students? So students who might want to come onto campus one week but actually would prefer to study remotely at another time, how can we build in that choice to our design, and also how can we resource it? And is that something that we can actually do? But I think we really need to think about it. And finally, I think we really need to take students with us on this journey. We need to include them in how we design and what works, and get them to think about what the future looks like. And that's something that we're doing in Liverpool, asking our students, you know, we've asked them the question, how do you think your programme would be run in 20 years' time? What kind of things should we be doing? And they came up with all sorts of great ideas, some of which we don't know how to fulfil yet, but it was great to have the ideas anyway.
Great, wonderful. Thank you, Lisa. Yeah, absolutely. You know, it will have to mirror government's intentions. Thank you. And Roxana, what are your views for the future of flexible learning?
I think both Lisa and Keitha have covered quite a lot, but I do have two or three points that I think we do need to make. So I do think that the future of flexible learning is quite bright indeed, and many are interested in it. But I do think we're going to need to get beyond, certainly in our context, about it's not just when students learn, if they learn part-time, occasionally full-time or through credits, but also to get involved in the what of learning and the how of learning. So in terms of the what of learning, we pay quite a lot of attention on student involvement in developing coursework, etc. You all may know a big movement in South Africa and to some extent in the UK around decolonizing higher education. So that's a big part of, if we're getting involved in the flexible learning, then it's what of the students need to be involved in what they learn and how they learn. I also think that COVID has accelerated the interest and the appetite for flexible learning. And a big part of this will be tech-driven, whether we like it or not. So what does this mean for the future of flexible learning? I do think one area that's going to need attention is assessment. Assessment is definitely going to need attention. And I think as universities, we need to shift from what we've always worked on, academic honesty and plagiarism, to something around academic integrity. And I think as we move to flexible learning, we're going to have to start talking about academic integrity. And this then becomes a core value of higher education. So Keith, that gives us a new value to champion, especially with all the competition that's around us who don't always value integrity and so on. I think that's a new clarion call for universities. So in the domain of assessment, as we move to flexible learning, I think assessment is going to be an issue, and particularly academic integrity of assessment. Then I do want to point out that, Lisa, while I agree that we should move towards a situation where everyone can access anything all of the time, I think COVID has shown us that universities are high-pressure environments, and multiple modes can put massive cognitive demands on students and on staff and the mental health of students and staff. And so taking students and staff with us, making a bottom-up approach to flexible learning is going to be key because of this kind of cognitive demand in terms of high flex and hybrid. I also think that tech is going to be a big part of flexible learning in the future. So if it's going to be a big part, then I think we need to start thinking about systems and processes that protect the whole sector from unscrupulous data providers, MNOs, etc. And there, I really think we're going to need to be, as a global community of academics, we're going to need to be proactive and build solidarity among higher education institutions around governance, so that we're not taken in by unscrupulous providers and then we become subservient to the providers because we're so dependent on their technology and on their data. We have to ensure that costs are contained, that there's protection of university IP, and that actually we're not at the mercy of these providers and MNOs. So for me, as we think about the future, I think we need to think about global solidarity as higher education institutions. And then the most important point for me would be that we need to ensure that we're inclusive and responsive in whatever form we take in terms of the future of flexible learning in higher education. We need to find ways in which they do, in fact, serve the very populations universities were set up to serve in the first place.
Great. Thank you very much, Roxana.
Perhaps if I can just make an observation. I mean, as we said, we're from three different continents, but I hear our issues are very, very similar, especially in Australia where we've been closed to the world for so long. It's a nice reminder to remember that we're not alone and that we do, as you say, Roxana, have colleagues all across the world, and there is possibility for us to be more solid and look after each other. As I was sort of saying, government policy has been very tough on universities in Australia recently, and I'm sure you all have your own challenges in your own countries. So it's great to have mutual support.
Absolutely, and I've learned a lot from both of you this morning. It's been great to chat, and I'm going to look both of you up and look at both of your universities and see what you're doing and see what we can learn. And no, I agree with you, Roxana. It's a global issue, and we need to address it together, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. It's something that's really interesting about COVID is it collapsed time and space. That's why the four of us could meet at very different times in the day to be able to share ideas, which we never did before COVID. So it has really collapsed time and space in significant ways, and that we should really use to our advantage.
Definitely.
I agree.
So thank you very much, Roxana, Keitha, and Lisa. That was a really insightful discussion and a lot of thought-provoking and food for thought. And, you know, I echo Lisa, I have certainly learned a lot from this discussion. So thank you very much.